Call meeting to order, please. I'd like to call for a moment of silence, please. Stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Just a bit of housekeeping, if I may. We would request that if you have any electronic devices, such as cell phones or iPads or whatever they're called, that you turn them off. It will interfere with our sound system, so appreciate it if you would turn them off for us. Oh, come on now.
Okay. Well, he does have short-term disease, doesn't he?
You're like the guy that gets kicked off the airplane. What's his name? The actor? Okay, if we could have roll call, please.
I'll put on the city clerk's hat.
Oh, wonderful.
Charlie Hawkins.
Here.
Dennis Ellison.
Here.
Bonnie Onion.
Here.
Harry Robinson.
Here.
Ken Oblinger.
Here.
Clark Cotner.
Here.
Paul Greeno.
Here.
First order of business this evening is recognition and awards. And the first item we have is the Blaine Builder Award for Leslie Smith. If Leslie could come up to the front, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
ventures that she's encountered on the first while several African students were moving.
Well, first I want to say thank you very much for this award. It's really an honor to receive it. I know that the city of Blaine plays a really important role in this trip to Japan. We get pins from the city to take over and share with students, families, and other people that we meet at random while we're in Japan. Mayor Robinson offered a letter to take to the mayor in Funabashi, which was greatly appreciated. And so that bond of friendship goes beyond just the students and the families. It goes with the city to city. And they're very appreciative that we've created this bond and this relationship with them. The most fun thing about the trip is the students and what they experience when they're in Japan. The one fabulous part of it is that they stay with homestays. So they have an experience of living with a family, not staying in a hotel, not being alone. And so by being able to share that culture with a family, trying to learn the language, trying to communicate in different ways. Some of the families don't speak any English, and some of them speak quite a bit of English. So it's a challenge for some of the students to actually be staying in a home and sharing 10 days with a family. But when they leave there, it really has become their family. There's lots of tears shed. They're not wanting to leave. They've really created a bond with them. The festival itself is fabulous. It's held in an arena that holds 6,000 people, which is more than the city of Blaine has in population. So that's really an eye-opener for the kids to be in such a place that's so big, so vast compared to the Whatcom County area. I think it just really says a lot and opens their eyes to what's available to them in the world and what's around and why there are situations that happen in other parts of the world, just in terms of population and culture. So the festival has 1,000 musicians, or over 1,000 musicians participating, and our high school band of 44 students was part of that 1,000 plus students playing in the, or community members playing in the festival. The end of the festival is all of the kids that are involved in the festival are all dancing together and singing together. So it's really, really exciting and just a really wonderful experience. Of course, something like this can't be done with just one person. It's certainly not done with just me. There's lots of other people who really have to help in getting everybody to Japan and getting this thing paid for, getting it rolling. So Dorita Gray, Bob Gray's wife, is really critical, and she's here tonight. She's really critical in helping raise all the funds that we need for each student to go. Without her help, it really wouldn't happen. Without all of the chaperones that take the kids, it wouldn't happen. Without all of the support from the rest of the community, it just wouldn't happen. So this is a great thanks for me, and I'm really happy to be honored. But it's a community, and it takes a community to raise a child, and it takes a community to get Blaine High School Wind Ensemble to Japan. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Leslie. Michael, do we have any audience participation signed up on the sheet there?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, the next item of business is commission, committee, and board reports. Clark, do we have any on the Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee?
No report.
Ken, about the countywide economic development?
No report.
Boys and Girls Club?
No report.
Blaine Chamber of Commerce, Bonnie.
No report.
RED Loan, Bonnie.
No report.
WTA Board, Paul.
The board met, talked briefly about the proposed fare increase, and decided that we were fiscally in good enough shape that we could table that idea for another year. Let's see. Oh, the second item is that historically bus systems try to recover 10% of their costs through the fare box. In other words, a traveler on the bus pays about 10% of what a bus trip actually costs when you factor in management and capital and depreciation and so forth. We're running at about 15% now, so we're doing better than the benchmark standard throughout the state of Washington.
Thank you, Paul. Charlie, anything on the Drayton Harbor Shellfish Advisory Committee? Dennis, the Library Committee.
They met last Wednesday, and one of their concerns is storage. So they were trying to figure out something they could put together.
Okay.
The other thing, they're continuing with the culture studies of the community.
How about the Senior Center Liaison?
They've been having the people from ARRP come in and help with packing. And I think it's later this month, they're also going to have a driving class.
Okay. Planning Commission, Mr. Jones.
Now that we have seven seated commissioners, we are back and rolling. The Planning Commission had a meeting two Thursdays ago, and we will have one this Thursday. This Thursday, we're going to give them the full range of things. They'll be looking at a plat in a public hearing, and that's out in Semiahmoo. It's been a while since we've had a preliminary plat proposed in Semiahmoo. It's actually been a while since we've had a preliminary plat proposed anywhere in Blaine, given the downturn, but there is one that we're looking at this week, and they'll also be having a study session on a code amendment as well, so it seems to be going really well. And no report from the Department Secretary.
Chief, do we have anything on the Law and Justice Council?
No meeting and no report.
Okay. Small Cities Caucus. Gary, would you like to comment on our discussions with our federal representative?
Were there three of us there?
There were three of us there.
Yeah. Well, we can tackle this one. The Small Cities, the highlight of the Small Cities Caucus was that Representative Del Bene was there and visited for about a half an hour with the mayors and managers and administrators and others who were at the meeting and talked about some of the issues that she's encountering as a new member of the House of Representatives, and we talked about some of the committees she's on. So she gave a real interesting presentation. And I'm sure that Harry and Ken will agree that I was very impressed with her, and I think we have a winner when she was elected. She's going to do an excellent job. After that, the primary business was the review and decisions made on the Port Grant program, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a little while. But that was it. Anything? Did I miss anything?
There's only one thing I wanted to add. We had a pretty substantial conversation. I gave a report from our inbound recruitment team.
Okay. Yeah.
And we talked at length about a conversation that we had this past month about the perception of whether it is better or not to do business in Skagit County or Milwaukee. That we hear oftentimes how much easier it is to do business there, that people are much more welcome there to do business. And what prompted the conversation is that we recently had a report that came out that compared traffic impact fees in Whatcom County and Skagit County. And what we found was that we actually have, in many cases, lower traffic impact fees here than we have in Skagit County's cities. And so the conversation went from there to, well, maybe what we ought to do is look at a comparison of cost of construction in all 11 incorporated cities, the seven here and the four in Skagit County, and see where the differences are. And so that was actually launched today. It's about a two-week study where we're working with all 11 cities, and we're going to get rough ideas on a common commercial building and a common residential building, what the cost of permitting is, so that we can see what the comparison is. And my guess is, from what we're seeing so far, that we're going to find that in many cases, especially outside the city of Bellingham, it is just as quick, if not quicker, and it is less expensive to do those projects here than Skagit County. And we're really going to push that out to make sure that people know that. Try and get away from this idea that just because it's difficult in Bellingham doesn't mean it's difficult in all the other jurisdictions of Whatcom County. So.
Okay, appreciate that, Ken. Okay, the Whatcom Council of Governments, no report. Chief Hollander, how about the North Whatcom fire update?
Excuse me, Council. Got my glasses tonight, so I'm prepared. Chief. I brought you a copy of our February Chief's Report that we presented our commissioners. It starts out with some statistics. You'll notice the month and the year are the same because these are January statistics for us. So for medical responses, we had 275 requests for service. For fire, or 207 to fire, we had 68 for the month. And I'm not going to read everything to you. We've got some property loss and value saved that we're now starting to track. And in District 21, we're at almost 80% value for saved. So that's the number we're trying to stay at, around 80%. That's a good national average. On the next page, I've highlighted, of our 13 stations, I've highlighted year two that you'd be interested in, Blaine and Semiano. There were 55 incidences in Blaine and 5 in Semiano for the month of January. And there's a little bit about some of our personnel. We've had some longtime volunteers resign with us. Paul Van Dyken was with District 4 for 32 years. Ken Schroeder for 25. And Dale Rutgers, if anybody knows Dale Rutgers, he's been with the district for 37 years. And he found a loophole where if he retires for 3 months, he can actually come back and volunteer for free. So this gentleman is retiring after 37 years. There's no more pension for him because there is a small volunteer pension through 25 years. And he can't wait to come back. He doesn't know how he's going to make it for 90 days without his pager. Just phenomenal guy, great truck driver. So that's on Dale. One of our firefighters and his wife had a baby born on Super Bowl Sunday, so I don't know how much he saw of the football game, but he was pretty excited about that day. You probably noticed if you've been driving around that there's some new station signs.
Yes.
We've been told that nobody really knows who North Whatcom Fire is because it says Delta Fire, Blaine Fire, Laurel Fire Department. So we've kind of gone through the district and posted over the existing signs with some new plastic signage. So everything now says North Whatcom Fire and the station number on it. So that will help with identifying some of our identification issues. We did have a retirement party for Paul Van Dyken, a little bit of a update on the EMS. Jack Laus came out to the chief's meeting and gave us an update on where we are with EMS in the in Whatcom County. Again, it's not moving as fast as everybody hopes, but we'll keep plowing through that one. At the end of this week, we get our annual audit, so that'll be interesting to see how we're doing there. We're not expecting anything. Operationally wise, we've got 305 business inspections for the city of Blaine scheduled this year. We have four shifts, of which Leslie Smith, who just left, is the lieutenant of one of those. So she's been assigned 76 in each shift. We'll do 76 inspections, and those will be done throughout the year. Our fires have slowed down, thankfully. We've got a couple of fires there, although we did have, unfortunately, a fatality fire weekend before last on Willie's Lake Road. That nozzle forward, you can disregard that. I tried to cut out what you might not be interested in. And I missed the cut and paste on that one. There's some pictures of some of our folks at a training we had, some of our staffing statistics for you to read through, and then from the fire marshal side, the Blaine School is getting ready to do their life skills classroom and high school and middle school modernization project. They plan on doing that the work this summer. And so the permitting and process and the fire sprinkler inspection and everything starts now well ahead of that time. And their goal is to have all that work completed before the school goes back in session in September. Other than that, we are working on Semiama Marina on trying to get their standpipe system back in service. A letter went out today with regards to that. And we are working with a property owner right next to the fire station in Semiama that's doing some selective log clearing. And our Board of Commissioners have authorized me to work out the logistics of getting them to use the driveway at the fire station to access his property so we don't have to put in another curb cut or a gutter or go over the bike path. And you guys were in support of that, and I expressed that to our board, and so they're all aboard for that. So I'll work out the details with that property owner. Okay. Any questions?
Since I live in Semiama.
You live in Semiama.
We have the worst response time. Is that your particular reason for that?
No,
You have the worst response time? I thought there were some other worse ones, but none of them are worse, actually. You just have the slowest.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all good. They're all good. The other ones are just exceptionally fast, and yours is just probably average. We're working on that. We're working on trying to get some more volunteer support out of the Semiahmoo Station. The 20 years that I've been here, it's been very challenging to get any volunteers out of that Semiahmoo area. So your responses are coming from the Birch Bay Station. But you're probably getting our best crew. So, you know, there's a we may be there a little slower, but we're going to be really good when we get there. How's that?
Thank you, Chief. I couldn't help myself. Okay, we're now to the City Manager and staff reports. Mr. City Manager.
Thank you, Mayor. The first thing I'd like to do is ask if we could have a brief executive session at the end of the meeting. It shouldn't take more than a few minutes to discuss a real estate issue. Okay, let's begin with Raven and Public Works.
Okay. Good evening. Just a few things to report to you this evening relating to projects. First, the Harvey Pipeline Water and Electrical Project that we've been looking forward to is opening bids this Friday, so we would expect a bid award from you at our next council meeting. At the same time, we're going to also open the building demolition salvage bid that we told you we were going to do for the two buildings in the right-of-way on the airport property. Depending on the outcome of those bids, we'll give you an update on the outcome of that at our next meeting as well. Wanted to let you know that we are on the draft offer list for a DOE water quality grant. We didn't get in the Bellingham Herald like the city of Bellingham did. They were number two, or their project was number two. We have project 26 and 45. So we are also very hopeful that we will in fact be funded with the passage of the state budget, depending on what our new governor does with that budget. Number 26 was actually a project that will enhance the Vista Terrace ULAD project. What we included in that is GFFs for 54 homes would be covered by grant. And we have, in addition, the funding for decommissioning and the physical connections of the septic systems to the new main. So this was intended to complement the ULAD project, which, as you know, only covers the actual sewer main construction. So for us, to be able to pay back the loan for the Public Works Trust Fund, it made all kinds of sense to try to get some help for our residents with the connection costs. So we're really excited about that. State has a public comment period open until the 20th of March. We would anticipate after that date, hopefully a more firm offer, but that may end up waiting depending on where the state sits with the budget process. It may end up waiting till July before we're officially notified. So that is that. You will see in your consent agenda that we are showing complete project for street improvements on Marine Drive from the roundabout to the trail. That project, as you know, included city, port, and TIB funds. So we're very excited about being able to close that project out. In your next meeting, we will be including for you a surplus resolution for the old wastewater treatment plant, the Seelich site. That will then be later sold after it's surplus, hopefully sold or transferred to the Mormons. A long-term idea. And finally, next Monday is our joint work session with the Birch Bay Water and Sewer District, so that's at 5:30 here. I am looking for anyone who may have access to video equipment. One of the Birch Bay Water and Sewer District Commissioners is not going to be able to make it. And being as we do have our presentation coming from our hydrogeologist, we thought it would be really neat to kind of record that. Also, just for the interest value, because there might be some of our residents that might have more interest with the groundwater and some of the other wonderful qualities that we have in our watershed. So that's all I have for this evening.
Question for you. How many folks have you got counsel for the Monday meeting?
Well, nobody has told me that they could not make it next week. Now, Paul, I don't know if you were here when we originally announced it.
So. We were not here, but I expect to make it.
So, as far as I'm aware, all seven of you.
Is that what we want?
No, that's great. It's a work session. Yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah, this is something that's identified in our agreement with them that we would try to meet as a joint board and kind of talk about some of the shared values of our partnership. And so, I mean, we've been jokingly talking about it for a month, but I am really excited that it's happening. Yes, sir.
I'm not sure whether this is the place to ask it or under public safety, but have we discovered the offending party and all the tree topping that have done over the truck crossing yet, or have you given up on that?
I think I'll let public safety answer
public
the question.
Safety, okay.
Is half an hour enough for us to cover everything?
I think we're going to be closer to an hour, sir. Next week?
Yeah.
5:30 to 6:30.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll go to Chief Haslett.
No report.
I think Chief Councilmember Offinger wanted an update on the tree talk investigation.
If you're allowed to tell us anything, are we in super secret mode?
Is this a whole?
I'm glad I asked this question.
Is this a Homeland Security issue that...
Safe to say that we've, so far as I know, included all but two of our interviews. We have a little bit more follow-up to do, and we'll be providing a copy of our report to Public Works and to DOT.
I have every faith in you. Thank you, sir.
We're doing as a thorough and let's just say as thorough as we can. Make sure we've answered everyone's questions.
I look forward to the report of the police blotter in the
Was there a presumed?
Oh, I'm sorry. A little bit of background for those who are interested. There's some landscaping trees on the east side of the truck route down just a little bit before you get to the commercial area. So you crest the hill at D Street and you're heading down towards the duty frees and the brokerage firms. On the right-hand side is a truck pullout, and some significant trimming was done to some of the trees in between the truck pullout and where the business is down there. And there's a question about whether or not it was authorized work, and if so, how it came about, who did it. So we've put a little bit of boot leather into figuring out.
Is there a presumed reason why that would have been done? View or something?
It turned out that there was nothing malicious about it. There was a practical reason for why the action
there
was
taken.
So.
You can't say, though?
Not until we finish up all the interviews and just dot all the I's on it. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have a question?
No, but I want to tell Raven. I won't be here next week. She's assumed that all of us are going to be here.
Okay. Raven, Mr. Kottner would like to make
you've made an assumption that we're all going to be here. I will not. I'm going to be out of town. Okay. May I be excused, please?
We'll have to work on it. Clark can't make it either. So more reason to try to find some video equipment.
Okay.
So we can record it for you.
Okay, if there are no other questions for Ms. Haslop, we'll go to Michael Jones for the Community Development Services report.
I have a report for you on something that...
Oh, my.
If you had told me a year ago that I would be standing here giving this report, or if you had told me 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, I would be standing here giving you this report, I would have said, no way.
And yet, here you are.
And yet, yes. And yet, here I am. This is probably a topic that you may have had some questions about as the law is in the process of changing, and might wonder how it's going to potentially affect the city, and that is why I'm here. And Chief Haslop is going to address some of the sort of law enforcement public safety related issues at the end of the discussion here on land use. I'll make a couple of stopping points where I'll ask you if you have questions, but maybe let me get through a few slides and we'll stop and go through a few slides and stop. Excuse me one second while I get this ready. So, the presentation is about marijuana, medical and otherwise, in this case, recreational. And as you probably are well aware, the voters of the state of Washington passed an initiative this past election to legalize marijuana under state law and to essentially make it okay. Previously, there was action taken for medical marijuana, Initiative 692, and so I'll give a little bit of information about that and then talk more about the I-502 topics. So first of all, medical marijuana was essentially legalized, and I'll explain that term in a moment, in 1998, again, it was an initiative, so it was a pass by a majority of the citizens, a majority of the voters, and it legalized medical marijuana, so marijuana for use as medicine. And by legalized, it's an interesting term to use when we talk about this, because marijuana is still a level one controlled substance under federal law, so it's not legal under federal law. But Washington State essentially decriminalized it for medical purposes, and they created it. What they did at that time was they created what's called an affirmative defense, which essentially gives a person who were to be stopped or arrested for having marijuana or using marijuana an opportunity under the law to more or less say, yeah, I had it, but here's why. The most extreme example of an affirmative defense is murder in self-defense. You're not saying you didn't do it. You're saying, I did it, but here's why. And so it's the same concept was established for medical marijuana under Initiative I-92. It didn't have a whole lot of attention until more recently in 2011 when there was Senate Bill 5073 was passed, and that was the thing that you heard about that was basically going to codify a lot of it. It was going to set up a whole new system of state licensing of people to provide the medical marijuana and the whole just essentially system is the only real way to describe it. But large parts of that were vetoed by Governor Gregoire. As I understand it, after she met with some of the federal officials, she determined that she didn't want to put state employees in a position of issuing licenses for what the federal government was determining was an illegal activity. So she line item vetoed out sections of that bill, but a lot of it did still pass, or a lot of it did still become law. And It allowed for essentially self-supply, so someone could grow their own marijuana for medical use. It also allowed for collective gardens, which meant a group of people could get together and grow as sort of like a co-op. I guess it's just, you know, sort of the, it's a little easier when multiple people are doing the same activity or maybe having a little bit of economies of scale, so to speak, because you don't have to reproduce everything over and over again. And it also allowed for providers, where one person could grow marijuana to provide it to a medical marijuana patient. And so maybe the person was too ill to do it themselves. Or I also think of the instances where those people, that every plant they touch dies. You know, some of us just don't have a green thumb. So it had an allowance in the law for someone growing it for someone else. It did not have an allowance in the law for a dispensary, which is one of the things that people kind of took out of the 1998 initiative and tried to use. And a dispensary was basically a marijuana store. It was, if you will, it was a drug store for marijuana. And you could go and get it from the marijuana pharmacist, and then the next person could come in and get more, and the next person could come in and get more. But that's not legal. In 2011, it was really never quite intended to be legal, I don't think, under I-692. And in 2011, they formally established a 15-day waiting period between customers, essentially. So a provider can provide to someone. They can be a provider. But if they're going to switch to provide to a different medical marijuana patient, there's a 15-day waiting period between that. So it really makes it impossible to kind of run a business and provide the service to customer after customer under the existing state laws. One of the things important in that whole discussion is that there was an allowance or there was a requirement that medical professionals, a certain listed group of medical professionals, different kinds of medical professionals, had to essentially write, if you will, quote unquote, a prescription for the marijuana. So you couldn't just say, I have a headache, I'm going to go get some. You had to go to your doctor or to your naturopath and have them essentially write a letter that said, you have a reason, here is the issue, and here's why it is treatment for your condition. And so it wasn't just open, it wasn't an open free-for-all. In that particular set of rules and regulations, they did lay out that it was perfectly legal, and there was nothing that was stopping cities and local jurisdictions from establishing land use regulations. They don't really need to do that in every law that's passed because we have the police powers and we are allowed to zone and we are allowed to have land use regulations that was determined by the Supreme Court a long time ago, but it was, in fact, included in that particular piece of legislative action. So that's essentially the background on medical marijuana. And you may recall when it first came up, we had some discussions, well, what are we going to do about that? And my advice at the time was, let's not do anything. Why rush to take any action? Let's see what happens. Well, to date, nothing, apparently, has happened. We've had no one try to open a dispensary. We've had no one become providers. We have no collective gardens. I suspect we probably do have people with medical marijuana cards or letters, and I suspect we probably do have people growing their marijuana and using it for medical purposes and otherwise. But we didn't have licenses sought from the city. We did actually have one person who, through the police chief, passed along a letter where someone was interested in opening a dispensary, and our response after we consulted was, dispensaries are illegal. So the answer will be no if you ask us, and if you open one, that we would act accordingly. So that was kind of where we are. We basically did nothing, and more or less nothing happened. Do you have any questions on the medical marijuana issue at all before I move into I-502? This is where it becomes more interesting. So I-502, passed just this past year, again, legalized marijuana for personal use. So unlike medical marijuana, this is just because you want to. And it legalized basically three different things, and it established that the state will issue licenses for three different things: for production, which is cultivation, processing, which is doing something with the raw material, and sales, which is retail sales to the end user. So the state will issue licenses for those three things. It does not allow the public consumption of marijuana, so somebody walking down the street smoking a joint is still breaking the law. You can't do it in a bar for a couple of reasons. One, you're not allowed to smoke in bars, but also because that's a public place. But it is allowed for personal use in private settings. It is taxed at 25% in each step. So when the producer sells it to a processor, there's 25% tax. And then at the next step, when it goes to the retail salesperson, there's a 25% tax. And then there's a 25% tax again when it's sold at retail from the wholesaler to the retail customer. And that's an excise tax, so don't get too excited, because that's not money for the local jurisdiction. That goes into what's considered, which is actually labeled the Dedicated Marijuana Fund, and it is by state law specified what that money will be used for up to a certain point, and then it kind of says, and the leftover will go into the general fund. And in one of the handouts that I gave you, on the back of one of the handouts, on the one on I-502, it actually sort of says percentage for this, percentage for that, and it tells you where that money goes. And then again, as I said, and the rest goes to the general fund, whatever that might be. Because it's retail sales, there's sales tax, just like anything else. So there will be the small local income potential from the sales tax, but it's not that big 25, 25, 25 tax. So it is, again, there's three steps. You can't be a retail sales outlet that grows it, processes it, and sells it. I'm fairly sure now that I understand the regulations as I do, that you can actually produce and process. At first I thought you could not produce and process, but you can, I believe. You don't have to, but you can. You'd need two licenses, apparently, from the state to do that. But you must have a separation between the producer and processor and the retail sales outlet. And I believe the reason for that is not only taxes, but it's a matter of control to some degree. It's a little easier for the state to see some of what's happening when there's some separation, some breaking points in the system. The locations are limited by the state in two ways. One, by market potential, essentially. Think about liquor stores before they moved into the private sector. You didn't have like 10 liquor stores in Ferndale or 5 liquor stores in Blaine. Yet you had basically one in each town, and a town like Bellingham might have had more. But it was regulated by the state, so they sort of limited the supply. And the idea was it was supposed to match demand. So there wasn't supposed to be a whole bunch of surplus. So there's that factor working. But there's also the locations are limited because there's a 1,000-foot distance buffer or separation for producers, processors, and retail outlets from a variety of different facilities that the state considers sensitive. Schools, playgrounds, parks, daycare centers, recreation facilities are on that list. So that 1,000-foot buffer actually has a pretty significant effect, and I will show you that in a few minutes. They also regulate signage, and they limit advertising. So you can't have like a big billboard across the street from the playground, even though the store is farther away. The same separation distance applies to signage. And then the size of the sign of the actual store is also dictated by the state. So like a local jurisdiction, we may have regulations that are more restrictive, but we can't have regulations that are less restrictive. And I would have you bear in mind that typically we can't make regulations for a specific industry, so we can't like say, well, the marijuana store can only have a 1-foot square sign, but all the other stores can have one this big. Ours have to be kind of general across the board. It is interesting that the state has taken that action, because I could see free speech advocates saying, whoa, wait a minute, a sign is a sign is a sign, as long as it's not vulgar or offensive, we get to have the same size sign as anyone else. But that's not our fight, that's the state's fight, if somebody goes. So that is essentially the general framework. So I'm going to try to talk about each step along the way and give you my interpretation, my analysis of what our laws do, what the city's laws do, and how the city and state laws interact related to this. So cultivation of marijuana is the production of marijuana. Some of the things that I think are important, that it should probably occur indoors, and it should be certainly be in a fully secured location. Security is an important component of the state regulations. And in our climate, you really can't grow it outdoors 12 months a year anyway. If somebody's going to try and run a business, you usually want to run it continuously. That's why you see hothouses growing tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers across the line of BC, because you know you want tomatoes and cucumbers all year round, and if you're selling tomatoes and cucumbers, you want to be able to make money selling them all year round. And I think the same thing generally would apply. But nonetheless, I suppose someone could grow it outside. We do have a growing season. It just might not be as successful. We may not want that, and I'll get to that. So looking at this as the land use guide, I'm saying, well, growing something is agriculture. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Growing a plant is not manufacturing a product, generally. We don't have regulations definitions that discuss it all very much, but initial interpretation, kind of using Webster's dictionary, that kind of level of thinking, and just your common sense, we're growing something is agriculture. It's not manufacturing something. And so what we could do is we could define indoor cultivation for the purpose of sales as manufacturing. We could do that in our code and say that if you're growing something in a greenhouse, that's manufacturing. And thereby we would limit cultivation to the manufacturing districts. And that's kind of important, I think, in my opinion, because we do allow agriculture all throughout the PR zoning district, which is basically all of East Plain. It's a lot of land. It's right up against the border. It's fairly open. And then we're actually looking with the Planning Commission right now with allowing agriculture in the RPR zone, which is the semi-on the wetlands. So that's another really large open space. And for those reasons, I think we may want to look at that first idea, defining indoor cultivation as manufacturing of a crop. And that relates to other things, too. That's important. We're not just, when we put a definition in the zoning code, it doesn't just apply to one product unless you specify. And my advice would be not to specify. We've actually had people come in and say, hey, we'd like to grow ginseng in greenhouses in this area, can I do that? And I look at the code and I say, well, you'd need a conditional use permit because it's agriculture. And we don't really allow agriculture in the manufacturing district. But maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea. And so if we were to do that, it would apply to tomatoes, peppers, ginseng, mushrooms, you know, any number of different things that you can grow indoors, sell them for a profit, and grow some more. So anyway, that's the idea of cultivation. Processing could include any number of different things. Some of those things would be drying, shredding, de-seeding, packaging. You know, like if you go to buy pipe tobacco, it's not raw tobacco plant, giant leaves shoved into a bag. It's processed, it's chopped, it's like seasoned. Sometimes it tastes like apples and things like that, right? So that kind of process. Rolled cigarettes, you can imagine, you know, if you can buy 20 Marlboros in a pack, I guess you're going to be able to buy 20 something else. They're going to have a name, I'm sure, in a pack. Baking or mixing into consumable products. We've all heard the stories about brownies and that kind of thing, so that sort of thing will be there. Brownies, cookies, whatever, I don't know. There's also the idea of extracting the THC, which is the thing that gets you high, for infusion, to use it in other things. So just the extracting of it would be a processing activity. And then there apparently is the idea of infusing it into beverages, so you could drink something that would have it in it, much like we drink wine or beer. It has alcohol in it. You don't drink straight alcohol, generally. So basically, this is the creating a product from a raw material, the raw material obviously being the plant product, and then the processing, turning it into something that's value-added, so to speak. This is a permitted use in various zoning districts throughout the city. We have a lot of places where we allow this. And those are those districts generally.
the Gateway Zoning District, which is, you kind of know where it is because most of it includes the airport property. That also, some of that includes, allows manufacturing as well. It didn't highlight here because we didn't quite select all of the right zoning districts. But you'll see in a moment why that's completely irrelevant, that it wasn't highlighted here. In any case, those are the zoning districts that permit manufacturing. This is the 1,000-foot buffer as it applies in Blaine from schools, parks, daycare centers, and other such locations. You can see it's a pretty big orangish-yellow blob there that comes into play. We didn't show the Semiahmoo uplands and the spit, most of the spit, because it's all residential, so it doesn't really come into play in this discussion. But you can see the buffer encroaching from that side because the county park is a park, so therefore there's a 1,000-foot buffer there. But the end of the spit, out like where the hotel is, you could sell. I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, there's the 1,000-foot buffer, and this is how that interrelates with the manufacturing districts. So you can see some pretty big chunks are taken out, but not a lot, because we don't have a lot of parks and schools and such in our manufacturing districts, for obvious reasons. But Skolman Park takes out a big chunk, and then Lincoln Park, and that's about it. The rest of it would be eligible for areas where someone, if we were to define things, as I'm going to suggest, could grow and could process marijuana. Any questions on that before I move on to the next topic?
The brown area is
where you could grow and where you could process both.
But didn't that other overlap all
of that? I'm sorry?
Did the 1,000-foot thing overlap all that?
The fall was here.
The 1,000-foot does not overlap all of that.
Can you go back to the 1,000-foot one again?
Yes.
So the dark yellow is what?
The dark yellow are the actual facilities that are being buffered. So, like, you can see the state park up in the corner.
Okay.
Or you can see the big orange, dark yellow in the center. That's the school district's property, the high school.
And then the light yellow is everywhere you can't do it.
Is the buffer everywhere you can't do it around those facilities. 1,000 feet is a pretty big distance, almost a quarter of a mile.
So there are a couple little tiny white squares in there, or am I not looking at that?
There are a couple little tiny white squares, and what those are places that are outside of the 1,000 feet, and they're being encroached in from every side like that. So they're making white shapes because they're not within the buffer. Do you see what I mean?
But those are residential areas, so they don't apply any of this.
Right.
You go to the slide, they're not.
Exactly. You can see they're not manufactured. So they're not they're not really relevant. They're outside of 1,000 feet from a school or a playground, but since there it's a residential neighborhood, you're not going to be able to manufacture.
Okay.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to move on unless there's any other questions related to that. So the sales of marijuana, it will be done just like the other things, as under permit by the State Liquor Control Board. There's a review process. Like if someone wants to get a liquor license now, there's a review process. We get, it's actually sent to Gary, a notice that says so-and-so is requesting a liquor license at this location to sell either consumable, like on-site, or to retail it or such. And the Public Safety Department looks at that and community development looks at that, and if there's any real big concerns, we can contact the state, and in a couple instances have. But generally, it's not that big of an issue. And then they would need a business license in addition to the Liquor Control Board permit. They would need a business license. They'd have a state business license, and as you know, we use the online state system for our business licenses, so it's a one-step process for people. They pay for their city license and their state license at the same time. Those are reviewed by public safety, by community development, and by the clerk's office. And if we don't see an issue, like, for instance, if you wanted to manufacture in your residential neighborhood, I would see an issue. And I would say, wait, time out. Don't issue that business license. Let's talk to these people first and make sure we understand. But generally, if somebody asks for a business license, they usually get it because they're usually asking to do something that's legal where they can. Yes, sir. For what? No. And here's why. Selling a product is a Selling a product is a retail use, and retail is not permitted in our residential zoning districts.
Well, the reason I asked that question is some of these houses, some of these homes that are in these portals are like half and half residential upstairs.
So they're not selling in their house, they'd be selling in a business, in a business zone. So that would be, you know, a different situation where it's mixed use. But I would expect, and I don't have the law right here, and I'm not going to read it to answer your question, but I would expect the Liquor Control Board is going to say, you can't mix them like that. It needs to be a clearly separate use that is a store, and then a clearly separate place that is a residence, because of the separation of 21-year-olds and older from the younger folks, and who's allowed to have and be near the stuff. So retail uses, as you can imagine, are permitted in a wide variety of city zoning districts. And those are highlighted here in the pinkish color. And you can see the end of Semiahmoo Spit, all of the area down by the marina, the wharf district, the central business district, over by D Street is highway commercial zoning, up and down the truck route, and then down by exit 274, starts up around Hughes Avenue, Sweet Road area, and goes down all the way to Dakota Creek. So pretty big areas that allow retail use. And again, there's that slide of the 1,000-foot buffer. And when you do the subtraction, it leaves some pink areas. And starting from left, and we'll move to the right, on the left is the end of Semiahmoo Spit, when I was getting ahead of myself before. So at the hotel, conceivably, there could be an outlet. Then if we come to the right, there's just a little sliver. That is on D Street. It's on the south side of D Street. It's between 3rd and 4th, if I have my math right. The easternmost edge of it is Alley Auto, so the Napa store. And then you would move one block west. But that's just because of the way things fall with the buffers. It's only on the south side of the street, and it's only one block long. And then there's a big pink blob up by the truck crossing, which is, a lot of it is duty-free, and wouldn't that be an interesting sales? I don't think that's a likely spot to see a lot of stores opening up right next to the federal facilities, and since all those people are on their way through the international border, when marijuana is still illegal in BC. And so then below that, in the area near the airport, that is on the north side of Boblett, and it is the block between Grant and Boblett, from Ludwick over to the airport property. So again, it's just a small little chunk that doesn't get hit by the buffering. And then when you get down further south, you have the big area down by exit 274 and the Hughes Road, Bell Road area. And so it's the 1,000-foot buffer has a pretty significant impact. There is some interpretation on that. You frankly could say, you know what, the street ends here, they're not parks. They're just streets. Boblett, Cherry, Martin, but they're in our parks plan, so I highlighted them as parks. If you took those away, it would take the 1,000-foot buffer away from those and would open up more area. But we took kind of the most specific and rigid interpretation. And so those are the retail districts and the buffers, and leave some areas where stores can locate. So kind of here's how this all comes together. State law sets limits on the location for sales, processing, and production. So there's already a state system in place to do that, as I just indicated. The regulated growing, processing, and sales, as well as consumption in private, is permitted under state law. It's a legal activity. City laws will allow the issuance of business license for businesses located in the right zoning districts because it's a legal activity under state law. Sales is a retail use of land, processing is a manufacturing use of land, and production is an agricultural use of land. The agriculture issue leaves me with a bit of a quandary. So is there a need for city regulations? I think if we define indoor growing for sales as a manufacturing activity, that would be a wise thing to do. They're making it very specific. This is a manufacturing activity, and it won't be happening in the PR zoning district out in East Blaine. And if we were to change the regulations, as someone has proposed for the Semiahmoo Uplands and some of the big undeveloped properties there, and they, by the way, that has nothing to do with marijuana. Those folks, they proposed that long before this was even on radar. It's got nothing to do with marijuana. But when you allow, if you allow agriculture out there, it could. So I suggest that we define indoor growing of sales as a manufacturing use. And just to be very specific, to clearly disallow outdoor marijuana cultivation in all zones. So you got to grow it. If you're going to grow it, you got to grow it inside, because inside is secure, or it can be. It can be safer, and you have a much better ability to regulate anyone who comes in. I think so. We're not banning it from the city. We are regulating it to the indoors.
Michael, when you go to sell this, is it specific to the fact that you're just going to be able to sell it? You can't have sort of like a coffee shop so people could test out the product before they...
That's a great question.
...they bought it, or, I mean... Are you going to be allowed to smoke it there? I mean,
No. That's a really good question.
Whatever.
Let me explain that a bit. The retail outlets are only allowed to sell marijuana and marijuana-based products. So you could have a store that has raw marijuana and pop brownies and I suppose like hashish and some of the other things that are like products of it. And they can sell these infused beverages. I have no idea what this would even be, but I guess it's like you'd have a beverage, just like lemonade with marijuana in it. I have
chai
no idea.
Tea, I guess.
Like tea with marijuana. It would be tea for sure.
Beerawana.
But I don't think you can do that. That's why I want to say like beer with marijuana in it, but I don't think you can do that because that's alcohol. But maybe you can. So you can only sell marijuana products. You can't. This is the classic image. You can't walk past five rows of chips on the way to the marijuana. It's just the marijuana products. That's all you can sell in that store. And it is not, you cannot smoke it there. You cannot eat it there. You cannot drink it there. You can't open the bags. It'd be like an open container, that kind of stuff. You buy it, you take it home, and then you consume it. And so there's not a testing kind of allowance. You have to, you know, it's kind of like you break it, you bought it, sort of thing.
So how do you know if you like it, though? I mean, until you test it.
I guess you go back and ask for your money back. One of the interesting things about the regulations is it does involve a whole testing process. The state's going to go out and test it, and it's going to, like, regulate the THC content, and if you're saying it's, like, really high THC content, or it's kind of like the proof in a beverage, if you're saying this has this much in it, they're testing it to see if it, in fact, does.
Michael, if I need this for medical reasons, I'm still going to be able to grow it at home. Right?
That is the quandary that we have.
And for my neighbors. Hmm? Need it.
If your neighbor won, because you can't supply more than one person.
So if my neighbor needs it and can't grow it because they're disabled, I can grow it for them.
And if they have a doctor's or a medical professional's recommendation that they have it, and they designate you as the producer for them, you can grow it, but you can't smoke it. You can just provide it to them.
Yeah, I'm just doing it for them.
Yeah. But then I'm just being clear. I didn't think you were going to.
I've got my own supply going as well because I need it.
Theoretically, you can have your own supply going as well, but that would be against the law. Unless you were also a medical marijuana customer. There's a fair amount of speculation right now that the whole medical marijuana thing is just going to go away. There's really no point.
Yeah, but I can have it at home. I don't have to go and drive to the store to buy it.
Right. That's the only, but you have to go through the process of growing it. The other thing is that we don't tax medical marijuana because it's medicine, but we do tax the other stuff, so it's a revenue source if the state eliminates that. But we'll see what happens.
Now, does medical marijuana get paid by, as a drug? I mean, is it a drug?
Oh, I don't think anybody's...
Any insurance company?
I have no idea, but I think there are very few people that are submitting that to their provider, to their insurance company, and I can't imagine an insurance company paying for it. Because they don't pay for even the stuff they're supposed to most of the time. You know, it's hard enough to get them to pay for stuff you need.
Do you have to have a license to grow your own?
Okay, again, under 502, you can't grow it in your home. You have to be a provider. You have to be a state-licensed provider. And actually, I don't know that you can't grow it in your home. I'm guessing that the Liquor Control Board is going to make it illegal for someone to grow it in their home. That your license from the Liquor Control Board to be a producer is not going to allow for you to grow it in your home.
For personal use.
If you grow it for personal use in your home and you have a medical marijuana card, or you have a, I keep saying card, I don't think we do that in Washington, but if you're a medical marijuana patient, you can grow it in your home.
This is really going to cross the line for the police agencies because people are going to be growing it.
Well, and you know what? Let me finish up. I'm basically finished, and I think Mike can entertain any number of questions about that. It's very difficult at this point because we have you know how it works, right? There's a law, and then there are the regulations that are made underneath it, and the regulations are more specific, and they deal with all the different issues and nuances, and it's like the state passes a SEPA law, but then the Department of Ecology makes all the SEPA regulations, which is a great big book full of stuff. We only have the law, and top it off, it was an initiative, which aren't always the best crafted laws. So we have a law passed as an initiative, but we don't have any of the regulations yet. So it's really hard to answer some of the specific questions. Okay, so I've given you my interpretation. It is what it is. That's what I think. That's what I'm saying. And if you agree with the outcome of that interpretation, if you're comfortable with the outcome of that interpretation, then you don't need to take any action. We'll do our jobs, things will continue. We might have a cultivator, we might have a processor, we might have a store. We might have a couple, but we might not have any. We don't know, time will tell. So you do nothing. I'll do my job, Mike will do his job, Sherry will issue business licenses, we'll all go along our way. If you prefer a different outcome, I'm not changing my interpretation. You need to change the law. So if you prefer a different outcome, you would need to give me, and I would ask you tonight to give me, or in the future, any time when it comes up, give me direction to write a resolution to initiate something. I need to know kind of generally, what are you looking at? What would we do? If you pass that resolution at an upcoming meeting, then we'll initiate a code amendment, and just like anything else, it'll go through, or any other land use code amendment, it'll go through the Planning Commission. It will come to City Council after a public hearing. You can have another public hearing because it's a land use issue. And we can try and figure out what we want to do. Theoretically, because this always comes up, I didn't even want to put this in here, but it always comes up. Well, what about a moratorium? Well, you could. There's a six-month moratorium allowance. You have to have a public hearing after you declare the moratorium, and you can renew it every 6 months for a period of time. And you can just say, we're not opening any stores, or we're not opening any cultivation facilities. It's not allowed. You could do that. But you have to be headed towards making a law. And the other thing is, it's probably premature to do a moratorium, in my opinion, only because the state is targeting September to try and get the first licensed cultivators, and December for the first licensed retailers. So you could do a moratorium, but we're kind of ahead of schedule. But it'd be already due to expire by the time anything happens. But it would give us a window of opportunity to put in regulations if you chose to. I'm not recommending it, by the way. I do have a recommendation that it's not a moratorium.
Michael, who will be responsible for seeing that the regulations are carried out?
Which regulations?
The regulations that are going to be issued.
The state regulations?
State regulations.
It's a combination, and I think Mike's probably a better person to answer that than I am, but think of the liquor stores. The state was responsible for running the liquor stores, so they had a direct handle on it, but now they're not. But the state still licenses liquor vendors, and there's a tax there, and there's a liquor control board for the purpose of delivering alcohol to the stores and the customers.
And so the state has a certain level of responsibility. If that store is selling bottles of booze to 16-year-olds, it becomes the police department's issue. And then it obviously becomes a liquor control board issue as well, but there's different levels, and it would be similar. It's my understanding. And again, Mike can probably answer that better maybe when he gets up.
Yes, Paul.
To what extent do the state or local authorities have a responsibility for carrying out federal regulations? That may be better for the chief.
That would be better for the chief, certainly on one level, and it would probably be better for our attorney on other levels. I'll give you my interpretation, and when Mike gets up, maybe Mike can. I'm going to give you my interpretation. I'm going to finish my presentation, and then Mike's on. So, but I look at it this way. I relate it to wetlands. You are required to have an Army Corps of Engineers permit to fill a jurisdictional wetland. If the federal government says this wetland is under our jurisdiction, you need a federal permit to fill it. You also need a state permit, a state certification to be able to fill wetlands that would be regulated under state regulations. And you need to get a city critical areas ordinance. When I issue a critical areas ordinance, I don't issue them saying, you must get a Army Corps of Engineers permit. That's your obligation if you're filling a wetland. That's your issue with the federal government. And I'm issuing you my permit under my laws because I don't have the authority to enforce a federal law. So that's my interpretation on how it would relate to a land use issue. And again, let me finish up, and then maybe Mike wants to answer that from another perspective. Again, if you agree with the outcome of my interpretation, I'll go on my way and I'll do my job, and the rest of us will do our jobs, and that's that. If you prefer a different outcome, you have tools, you have mechanisms to initiate changes. And then just again, I would reiterate that I'm not going to change my interpretation necessarily. You'd need to change the law so I have something else to interpret. So what I would do, what I will do based upon what I'm seeing, is I would initiate on my own as the director, I can do that, initiate a code amendment to define indoor agriculture as manufacturing and to disallow outdoor commercial growing of marijuana in all zones. So grow it indoors, that's manufacturing. Grow it outdoors commercially, it's not allowed in any zone. Yes, sir.
So you wouldn't consider then disallowing outdoor commercial growing of any product, just marijuana.
Just marijuana.
Because
it's a unique product. If somebody wants to grow blueberries outside, somebody goes over there and steals some blueberries, okay, and they eat the blueberries, they're going to have blue lips, and they're otherwise going to be okay.
But if
a 12-year-old goes over and grabs the marijuana out of the farm, it's an entirely different issue. That is why I would regulate it differently, and that is why I believe we have wonderfully firm ground to stand on in making such a regulation. So that would be my first step there. In the interim, I would interpret the code just as though that had already been in place. If somebody came in and said, I want to, you know, turn this 40 acres into a pot farm, I'd say, sorry, we don't do that. You can grow it in Blaine, but you've got to grow it indoors. That's the only way we allow that if you're growing it for commercial purposes. And just the nuance there, I don't think there's any feasible way for me, or honestly anyone else, to regulate every single garden in every single house on every single property. So that's why that says for commercial purposes. Because if somebody grows a couple plants in their garden, how are we even going to know that's happening? And how are we going to eat? There's no feasible way for me to go out and enforce that. I don't like to make laws that I can't enforce, and I don't think we have the ability to do.
Michael, I saw a program the other day in California, and they allow growing indoors, but in every facility that they've approved, there are multiple cameras going 24 hours a day. And those cameras are tied to some center controlled by the state so that they at any moment can turn on the cameras and see what's going on in that facility. Are we going to be expecting something like that coming from Washington State?
I have a feeling that that's exactly the kind of thing that the Liquor Control
Aren't
Board
Aren't they going to want to regulate these production facilities?
Yeah, they're actually.
Because if they don't, then how the hell are they going to know what's going on inside it and in a closed facility?
Exactly, and how much are you producing and where is it going and all of that. And they're talking about a seed-to-sales control.
Yeah.
So right from the point of growing it and starting it all the way through to the end consumers, they'll be trying to regulate the flow. I think it's going to be very challenging.
How much you've got and how much production you've got and where it went. And the only way they're going to do that is if they have some kind of means of regulating that.
And I have no doubt that there will be a ton of regulations. We just don't know what they are yet.
Now, for example, when you say indoors, what does that mean? Does that mean indoors a closed building, or does it mean having, you know, some type of tent?
No, well, my interpretation would be a fully enclosed building and a greenhouse would qualify.
Greenhouse?
A greenhouse would qualify. Or in a warehouse under lights.
But that may come up in the regulations.
It may.
So are we jumping ahead of the game by doing this, or should we wait for the regulations to come up?
Well, we could wait for the regulations, but I think if we and the regulations are the same, then that's great. If the regulations don't do what we're talking about, then we have ours to fall back on. And we don't have to have open farms. So, again, as I'm saying, those are my suggestions. I would initiate a code amendment to do that. In the interim, I would just interpret the code like that's what it said. I would just tell people, no, here's the rule. But I have a lot of time to do it because we're not going to see any of this probably until September or later, and shouldn't be an issue. Otherwise, we will process business licenses per the city and state law and issue them.
Do you anticipate any?
Do I anticipate any what?
Has anybody made any inquiries?
No, one person has made an inquiry about being a dispensary for medical marijuana. And we have, I think, Chief and I have somewhat of a belief that maybe they were just trying to kind of get their foot in the door to be the store ready to go when stores were legal. So, I honestly, do I expect any to, and this is not based on my planning profession at all, it's just merely based on my observations of our population. Yeah, I do. I think we'll probably have a store in Blaine. Why wouldn't we? There's people out there that smoke marijuana. There's no. If you don't think there are, I think you're mistaken. We consume alcohol, and we have liquor stores. We've been trying to keep people from smoking marijuana for going on about 80 years now, and it's been pretty unsuccessful. And so if we make it legal, or it is legal, it is legal. So my impression is, yes, we will probably have a store. We may not have a whole bunch, because again, there's that whole regulation of quantity and supply, the demand with the state.
Michael, I kind of feel that you kind of thrown this at us, you know, and we really haven't had much chance to think about it. I would, it's up to the council, but my suggestion would be maybe we think about this until our next meeting.
Yeah, I didn't expect an immediate answer. I was just telling, I know this is probably to some degree on everyone's mind when you see the news stories and things like that. Absolutely, Mr. Mayor. I wasn't expecting an immediate answer. I'm just telling you, this is kind of the direction I'm going. And at any time, it could come up as another issue, and I'd be more than happy to have a study session and explain a little more of this. But there's not a whole lot more for me to explain because the rules aren't written yet.
Has anybody got any other thoughts, or do they want to act this evening? Or
Mayor, you might want to give Chief Haslop a chance to just comment on the law enforcement standpoint.
Sure.
Absolutely. And to reiterate, neither Michael or I expected any decisions from you folks tonight. This was very much just an introductory information session for you. Give you some food for thought, a little bit of background about what we knew to make it painfully clear that there's an awful lot we don't know yet because the regulations by the state have not been finalized, but that the train is moving down the track and we want to keep up to date with it. So
That being said, I just want to cover a couple of points that I have heard mentioned out in public in regards to implementation of the law, what we do know and don't know. You know, there were some of us that figured, boy, the morning after the law was passed, we'd have folks out smoking a joint and anywhere and everywhere they could just to express the freedom of having done so. Fact is, it's still illegal to do it in public. And the other fact is, we've not had a single marijuana-related call that we can say is specifically identified as being associated with the change in law, Initiative 502. We have stopped doing, of course, marijuana enforcement because marijuana possession is now legal in the state in quantities of 1 ounce or less, which was the vast majority of what we usually dealt with. On average, over the last 3 years, we have 6 or 7 marijuana arrests a month. We, of course, since the law was enacted, have had 0. Flip side of that coin is, this year to date, our overall business is up 7.5%. That's calls for service and arrests in other areas. So, and that's up over the average of the last 3 years for the first 2 months of the year. So perhaps it's a good thing we're doing a little less marijuana business because we need those clock hours somewhere else, especially with our staffing. So we do not have a crush of new marijuana-related activity associated with the initiative. Michael was correct in terms of the Liquor Control Board is running heck bent for leather to get all of the regulations that they need in place. Their goal is to have regulations implemented so that they can begin production in time to have crops processed and product for sale in retail outlets 1 year after the law had passed. So by the middle of or late next fall, you can expect to see retail stores and cultivation and production going on at different places in the state. When it comes time to decide where a retail outlet will be in Blaine and or if there will be a manufacturing site that wants to open up, the placement of that and the regulations regarding security will affect our call load, our business to some extent. And that's everything from ensuring the physical security of the site to how visible it is. The visibility may impact the amount of public complaints or public concerns we see about the facility, and whether or not we, the local agencies, get involved in compliance. If you remember back when gambling first passed a couple of decades ago, it didn't take long for local law enforcement to have to engage in assisting in the process of compliance checks for pull tabs and card rooms because the state lacked the resources. And there was a provision in the law placed where local agencies or local jurisdictions could have a gambling tax and to fund their compliance initiatives. That took about a decade for people to get really used to having gambling and for those regulations to, frankly, to have turned out in some cases to have been a bit of overkill. And there's been a reduction in the amount of that type of activity going on. Especially in our community. So we will see the state asking, I am sure, to some extent, for local agencies to assist in compliance because this is for the state of profit center. This is a means of bringing in revenue. And I'm sure they will be serious about wanting to not impinge on that revenue stream. They also have a deep concern that the state not become a source state or a source country of sorts, that they don't have bleeding of the product outside the state limits. That's why they want to control manufacturing, things like cameras and security systems and very strict end-to-end compliance to try to ensure that the product does not go outside the state to give the federal government reason to come in and impinge on this experiment. I don't think that local jurisdictions, except when it affects the public safety of our residents, want to engage in a high amount of compliance in these initiatives, simply because compliance implies violations of law, and our county prosecutors, our local prosecutors, understand that the citizens of the state legalize this product. The citizens of the state, to a large extent, don't want to see us continuing to attempt to enforce laws which they've told us to get used to. WSP and the state toxicologists are working out how we're going to handle driving under the influence of marijuana violations. It's different than drunk driving. We have a very standard, easy process, and more importantly, we have a box. Person blows in the box, and you find out what the blood alcohol level is. There is no such device for marijuana. It's going to be problematic because in a person's defense, if he doesn't think that he's under the influence, he's going to want a test. The only test currently is a blood test, and that means we and the person that we stopped are off to the hospital for a 2 or 3 hour process. So we're trying to figure out how we're going to make that work, and there's only one or two of us on, and most of the 8 smaller agencies in the state at any given time of day or night. More to that to come. And we certainly recommend that we continue talking about this as the year progresses, as we learn more, especially about the regulations, so that we can keep abreast of what is happening. More than happy to answer any questions you folks have.
Chief, you're not going to be able to rely on the customs or immigration people to respond to charges, are you?
It's a violation of federal law still. They're more than happy to find the violations for us and turn them over to us. However, and that's what they've been doing. That's why we went, we frequently go up to customs because they find personal uses of marijuana in vehicles on people's persons. And so we would write them criminal citations for the possession. We don't do that anymore because it's legal. Now, if a customs inspector or a border patrol officer wanted to take federal action, they would need to do that through the U.S. Attorney's Office. And unless you have something smaller than a duffel bag full of this stuff, the U.S. attorneys have other things to do. So.
Now, all of the people who work at the border, all the people at Homeland Security, all the people who work at plumbing, are all federal employees, correct? And they are not allowed to use marijuana or they could jeopardize their position with the federal government.
Most agencies, not just federal employees, even at the state and local level, if your jurisdiction has federal grants, you have to maintain a federal drug-free workplace. That means a zero tolerance policy on the use of drugs in your workplace. And that's been interpreted as including having a measurable amount of metabolites in your blood or in the samples that are taken. So if you have a commercial driver's license because you operate heavy machinery or a fire truck or a backhoe or whatever it is, if you're anyone subject to random drug tests, or if you're someone who might have to have a drug test following an accident or anything else, you don't want to have those byproducts in your system. So it's not just the federal employees. And we're very sensitive to that because we don't want to give the federal government cause to impinge on our grant processes and other things. So
it does make the world a little more complex.
It certainly does. It's not it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's something that we have to get used to. New ways of doing business. So, and we're trying to do it logically rather than overkill. Charlie? Sure. Frankly, I'm sure somebody has a logical answer for that, but I don't. You know, they have to, the security issues seem quite similar to me, at least at the retail level. So why can't you have an alcohol slash marijuana facility? I do not know.
I have a theory, though. I don't know, but I have a theory. The liquor store people didn't write the initiative. It was the people that want to grow marijuana and sell marijuana wrote the initiative.
You can only sell marijuana in a marijuana store.
Wait till they get it to Costco.
That's next. Giant bags.
You just go to Costco. Instead of buying milk, you just load up your cart with marijuana.
Paul?
How much is an ounce in terms of a little sandwich bag?
Oh, about a couple fingers worth. It depends on the product itself, how much THC, how dense it is. But two or three fingers worth, perhaps. It's a 28.8 ounces, or 28.8 grams per ounce, 16 ounces to a pound. So.
Yeah, I know that. If I were looking at a baggie, I wouldn't know how much I had in it.
It's up. Charlie's been doing research for me.
It's just as harmful as smoking, if you're going to smoke.
My understanding is it's got tons of bad stuff in it itself.
Better right. Friendly.
I mean, physically, you know, for your lungs, it's not good.
Yeah. You just get a brandy.
And that's just the nature of smoking. Any other questions, folks?
No, we're good. Right. Thank you, Chief.
Hey, Chief, thank you very much.
Well, if they come up, feel free to ask me. So, thank you.
Okay, Mr. City Manager. Okay. Jeff, do you have anything?
Thank you, Jeff. City Clerk's not here. City Manager.
I think the, I would not draw any conclusions from the fact that Michael seems intimately in. Knowledgeable about the subject.
I have been studying. Well, I see. Program on PBS.
Let's see.
Yeah, I spent a lot of
more discussion with one.
First thing, as I'm giving you an email from Cara Turner to Sherry. Where she outlines some dates that she would like you to kind of keep open or aware of anyway for the city manager search. And three of those dates are executive sessions with the council. And you can see that they're April the 15th, April the 26th, and May the 23rd, and May the 24th. Sherry has the responsibility of coordinating with Cara on the search, but Sherry is ill and wasn't at work today. And so I talked to Cara. Cara had sent this to Sherry, but she also wanted me to report that all of the information that needs to be put together to begin advertising the city manager position is finished, it's completed, and she's waiting for us to post it, post information on our website so that candidates who are interested in applying for the job can go to our website and get the information that that they need. And Sherry not being here today, she was not able to post that information. If she isn't working tomorrow, then I'll have someone else who's knowledgeable on how to do that go ahead and put that on the website. And we'll, according to Cara, everything's all set and ready to go in terms of the places where she's going to advertise the position. Do you have any questions
Gary, on that?
That website is our
website. Our website.
Our website.
The information will be posted on the city's website.
Can we assume that April the 26th, May the 23rd, and May the 24th are going to be sometime during the day as opposed to evening?
Yes, just I don't. My experience is that it would be during the day.
Yes. I would assume that those are going to involve some portion of the day. If
well,
not all the day for the.
Depends on how many candidates that you have, but you normally, if you're going to do interviews, you figure at least a half an hour per.
Well, if you're going to do Skype interviews, you're not going to do them in the evening.
You're not going to do them what?
You're not going to do those in the evening.
More than likely, that would occur throughout the day.
Yeah.
It's a matter of scheduling. If someone, you know, it's possible that you could only get someone during the evening for some reason.
Yeah.
But, you know, she'll try to put as much of that together as she can. The Skyping thing, I've never been Skyped in one of these, but I'm old and that's all new stuff to me.
I think you would have made an excellent candidate for Skype.
I think so, too, because I'm handsome.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Photogenic.
A handsome-looking guy.
Yeah.
Bonnie has a question.
Gary, on the May 23rd and 24th, so once we, okay, so prior to that, on the 26th, we do the Skype interviews, three, four, five, however many. And then on the 23rd and 24th, we're going to be going through those people and trying to select the final candidate. Is that what that means?
The final candidates will be here.
They will be here.
You will. My understanding is that it's during that time where your finalists will come here.
Yeah.
Okay.
They will go through the process, the selection process, whatever that ends up being. More than likely, a series of interviews, and then based on the information that you gather, you will get together with Kara and try to arrive at a conclusion as to who you want to offer the job to.
Okay. So the finalists come on those 2 days, or the 23rd, and then we make our final decision.
23rd and 24th will probably be, my understanding is those will be the days that the candidates will be in your
will be here. Okay. And they will be going through having staff interviews, right?
That's up to you.
Whatever we agree with.
Typically, the staff, the department heads, would have an opportunity to interview council, and then it's not uncommon that there be an interview by stakeholders in the city. For example, you look at agencies and organizations and that city manager would normally work with, so you may have an interview panel that has superintendent of schools and librarian and senior citizens and Boys and Girls Club and Chamber of Commerce and all of those entities that that we interact with. It's possible to have them come together and do the interview as well.
And that would have to be on both days also.
Yes. You can do them all in one day. You just move them in and out. I mean, they just move around. You can get three interviews in a day pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can do something in the evening as well, where you could invite a group of people in to meet with them. And,
yeah.
I just don't know if I'm going to be able to devote three full days to this because I'm working.
That's right.
I'll just make it as I can.
Yeah, as you can.
Well, it's important that you... If I were, you know, you would want to be involved in the interview,
mm-hmm.
and if you could be involved in the selection.
The Skype
discussion.
Interviews or the final in person?
Both.
So then you're talking 3 days.
Yeah,
On the 26th is the Skype interviews, and the 23rd and 24th are the in-person ones.
Will the Skype interview in the morning?
No, I don't think so. It'll be all day.
The 26th, you will be interviewing, and after that you will be determining which ones you want to bring here.
Mm-hmm.
So you may do 6 Skype interviews and then determine the 3 or 4 that you want to come for the final interview. So the 26th, you're not meeting with, you're meeting with the semifinalists,
mm-hmm,
to determine who the finalists are going to be, and then they will come in on the 23rd and 24th. The other thing in the process that's typically done is that they have a tour of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So you schedule that as part of the interview. They have an hour where someone takes them around. Chief Haslip's a good choice.
Well, that's going to take half a day right there. So maybe the council...
No. All this is... This is all scheduled so that if you have 3 interviews and 4 candidates, one is in interview 1, another one's in interview 2, another one's in interview 3, and one of them's on a tour with Mike. 1 hour later, this person moves to this one, this person moves to this one, this person moves to this one, the other one goes to Mike. You do that 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
Four times. And then you're done.
Mm-hmm. That's an all-day process.
It takes most of the day. Yeah, it takes most of the day. Yeah. Okay. Anything else on that?
No, we're good.
I thought that Cara was going to send the final profile that you had talked about with her, and for some reason I didn't get it. So as soon as I do, I'll get that out to you somehow. Either email it to you or put it in your box or whatever. City manager's report, 2 things. One is I mentioned to you that that Ken and Harry and I had an opportunity to be with Representative DelBene twice that day at the Small City Caucus meeting. And then she set up a round table that was held at TC Trading's offices to talk about immigration issues. She sits on the House Immigration Committee, which is a real hot topic right now, and they're going to be making some important decisions, hopefully, in the next 12 months, but she was interested in what the issues are on the northern border as they relate to immigration. And I think it's pretty obvious that they're different in many respects from what you're going to find on the southern border. But we had a good discussion. Mike provided us with some information from a law enforcement standpoint, and Ken had a good stuff on businesses, a business and doing business, that type of thing. And then we also talked about community issues, and a part of the draft of the immigration bills that I read that she provided, the one of the issues that they have identified is the relationship of border security and communities that are on the border. And so we use that as an opportunity to talk to her about the Bacchus.
I was wondering if that was going to
happen. Harry brought it up, and it was discussed at some length. She seemed interested in trying to figure out what she could do. I think there probably needs to be some kind of follow-up with her. But anyway, we talked about that, and we talked about other kind of issues living on the border. You know, the good things and the bad things about doing it.
Anyway, I think she's going to, she will, I think, visit us pretty regularly. She comes home every week. I'm sure she doesn't want to come to Blaine every week. Medina? I think that's right. Yeah.
Long trek up here?
Yeah. She went to referee school with, she went to referee school with Gary Jensen. She went to referee school with Gary Jensen. Yeah. They knew each other. Okay, now on the other issue that I wanted to talk a little bit about was I gave you some information about a direction on economic development for the community. And I mean, basically what I suggested in the information is that we initiate and involve ourselves in a process of trying to determine what it is that we want to do with economic development, particularly on the property that we own at the airport, but also in the industrial area around the airport. There's a high interest on the part of people that Clark's working with and others about moving ahead and getting some things done. I think that that we would agree that we need to, in doing that, we need to have some type of focus as to what works and what we can do, and to put it in Clark's vernacular, what kind of game are we hunting for, so that we know what kind of gun we need to take. And that's not a popular way to describe it most places, but as long as you don't misinterpret that in the newspaper.
We're the target quote.
The target, yeah. I gave you the little quote on the target. If you're trying to hit your target, shoot, and whatever falls, that should call it your target. So, I guess the suggestion in the information that I gave you was that is an effort that I think, and I think that, you know, some of you think is worth us pursuing. My big fear, is that somebody is going to come in and offer us a lot of money for the airport, and not knowing what the heck we want to do, we're going to take it. And then we're going to look at it and say, did we really want a gas station sitting on 8th Street? Or did we want something that creates jobs and a tax base for us? That's why, and as I mentioned, I guess I'm speaking more to the audience, but that's why we closed the airport. You know, we didn't close the airport because we didn't have enough gas stations. We closed the airport because we had information, you had information that suggested that there was a better and higher use for that property than having it stay as an airport. What we haven't done is to define what that use is, or what not just one use, but what are the kinds of things through some type of a rational process of collecting information and going through this in a logical, rational way, do we come up with? And once we know that, then how do we do it? That's my suggestion. We have met with a firm that has a great reputation. We met with them with the port and staff. I think they would do a good job. They have submitted a proposal, which I've given to you. I think they pretty much nailed the process, what we need to get done. The cost of that will be around $30,000. I'm suggesting that we use some grant money from the port, and we also use some money from the Red Loan Fund. which is meant to go towards economic development, and that between the two, we enter into an agreement with the firm and get them going in a process that, you know, that will probably take 2 or 3 months to get done. So that's my recommendation to you. If you would like me to pursue that path, then I will do it. If not, we can talk about what else, what other direction would you like us to go.
Okay, Bonnie, go ahead.
Gary, and this firm that you spoke with and gave the proposal, have they had pretty good success of coming up with, based on their research, of possible purchasers of the property and what's in the realm of possibilities? Have they had pretty good success in that actually happening?
Have they had?
That they targeted it pretty good where the particular piece of property that they were doing research on, in fact, went that direction?
Oh, they have. They've worked with some very, very big projects.
Mm-hmm.
Bellevue, they've done work, some of the commercial projects in the Seattle area. I'm trying to think of it. I think I know the name of the town. I used to know the city manager.
They mentioned they did the
Tulalip
project.
Yeah. They've done stuff all over the country. We're kind of small potatoes.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I think that, you know, their involvement with us is, I think, through an interest that Jim Hebert has. It's just a challenge, and he thinks that it would be an interesting project. And he also, you know, was very honest in saying that he hopes that this leads to other things that he might do, either for us or for potential businesses that might come to the area that need work done.
So he has good contacts, too, out there in the business world of firms that he can contact and say, hey, what do you think? Is there any?
I think that's true. His business interests are knowledge is pretty wide. Mm-hmm. He's well-connected. So he will be helpful there. But I think the first thing is that he has a very analytical approach to determining how the property is best used.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the kinds of types of business and industries that fit, the property fits into? And then you need to decide, you know, how does that fit with your vision?
I have one thing to say about this. I think it's a great idea. Give us some focus. Lay things out. And I think we should do it. So what comes next?
Well, what would come next is I would work with Jim Hebert's firm, finalize the scope of work and a contract, and you would authorize me to sign the contract, and we'd be moving forward.
You just need a show of hands now.
You what?
You need a show of hands
to do that, or what?
I just think that if I have a sense from you to go ahead and do that, then I will come back. I will come back with some formalized action for you.
Is anyone opposed?
No.
Good.
Next.
Thank you. Thank you for moving along, this guys.
And that's it for staff reports, I think.
Okay.
Everybody okay?
Yep. Public hearing. And none. Written communications. We got an email from Tom Williams, February 20th, 2013, regarding the Tribal Issues Conference. Okay,
anybody
next. Pardon?
Anybody going to that?
No, not that I'm aware of. Consent agenda. We have on the consent agenda approval of bills in the amount of 107,000. $794.87, and approval of the February 11, 2013 council minute, meeting minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Carries 7-0. We've got the Marine Drive project closeout.
That's part of the consent
agenda. I didn't read it. Okay, but it's in there. Okay, council action items is the next. Awarding of the 2013 grounds maintenance contract.
So moved.
The background summary really kind of summarizes things well. We've been contracting some of our grounds maintenance for years in an effort to kind of make things more responsive in a time of reduced budget and city forces. We modified the scope, and so I listed some of the changes in the scope. They're fairly minimal, but did result in a small amount of savings on a monthly basis. And based on the submitted proposals for groundkeeping services, we recommend award to Clean Cut Turf Care, who has been providing that service for a number of years, so we feel them to be sufficiently qualified, and we request your approval to award the amount of $49,848.24, including tax, for the first year. It should be noted that in the proposal process, we did identify a method and means for which our contracts can be renewed a number of years and how cost adjustments will be handled, so it's fair and equitable to both parties.
I move. Very question.
Pardon? Do we have a motion?
I move to accept it.
Second.
Yeah. Okay, we have a motion on the table to approve, and it's been seconded. Now, any questions or comments? Dennis?
Yeah, I had a question on the, did you reduce lawn maintenance to every other week in the summer? Good growing season, that's all grass.
Well, it was felt in the areas in which we're providing this maintenance that level would be acceptable.
It was only selectively done. It wasn't across the board in all areas.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments? Call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 7-0. Next item is to award an engineering services contract.
We reported, I think, late last year that we received a TIB grant for sidewalk improvements. This is west of the highway on Boblett alongside the school field primarily. And we solicited a statement of qualifications from our on-call roster. We reviewed four solicitations and determined that Pacific Survey and Engineering had the proper qualifications for the project. Just as an aside, they were the consultant that did the Peace Portal Trail for us. Accordingly, we negotiated a design contract with them for the work, and we request your approval to award a design contract to them in the amount of $21,531. At such time as we proceed with construction, we may or may not, depending on the nature of the project and our workload, we may or may not do a construction services contract with them at that time.
Move approval.
Second.
Okay, motions on the table. Are there any questions or comments? Let's call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 7-0. I believe we have an executive session. How long do you think the executive session will take, and will there be a vote following?
It will take 10 minutes, and there will be no official action.
Okay. And so we will break for executive session and reconvene in about 10 minutes.
Hey,